The following episode is sponsored by Never Quit Brand LLC. Unique clothing for unique people. Welcome back to Round 12, the podcast that will always be dedicated to growth, development, and motivational mastery. I am your host, Sensei Roger B. Hamilton. Thank you for joining us again today for another episode of the Round 12 podcast series. Let's go get it. Personal self-defense, and a few reminders to remember. First of all, with all the various martial arts styles, training methods, and individual teaching environments, the discussion about self-defense can get very intricate and sometimes sticky. As a card-carrying member of the professional martial arts community for nearly 5 decades now, I've experienced a tremendous cross-section of dialogue and personal training which could fill several book volumes. However, I've never accepted the golden, singular perspective to represent the one universal important thing to know or remember about self-defense. So I decided on today's episode to present a few points of interest that should be considered helpful and generally accepted, no matter whether you are male or female, or if you train in martial arts, or if you don't. The operative phrase would simply be common sense strategy. The first thing I want to talk about is the legal interpretation and definition of self-defense. Self-defense is using force or violence to protect oneself or a third person from imminent harm. In other words, the victim reasonably believes they are in immediate danger or imminent death, bodily injury, or serious bodily harm. This definition may seem simple enough, but it raises many questions when someone uses it in real life. It's important to understand that the specific laws on self-defense cases will vary from state to state. Some states have stand your ground laws, while others do not. This podcast episode addresses the broad concepts of self-defense law in the U.S., and you should check the laws of your state to understand the requirements for a claim of self-defense. But again, what is self-defense? Courts struggle with determining an appropriate level of force or violence when a person defends themselves. In reviews of what are appropriate levels of violence, courts often consider the following. What if the victim of a violent crime provoked the attack? Did the perpetrator threaten the use of deadly force or non-deadly force? Was the victim obligated to retreat from the violence or threat of imminent force? Did the victim have a reasonable belief or reasonable fear that the use of force against them was imminent? Did the victim use reasonable force in response to the attack? What protection exists for victims who feel on reasonable grounds that a threat exists when it does not? Self-defense law is more complicated than it first appears. To handle the many circumstances under which self-defense occurs, states have created rules to determine when self-defense is allowed. These rules also decide how much force a victim can use to protect themselves. Is the threat imminent is the first thing. Generally, self-defense only justifies using force in response to an imminent threat. For a threat to be imminent, it must be certain to occur. Such a threat can be made with words, as long as it puts the intended victim in a reasonable and immediate fear of physical harm or serious bodily injury. Without such a threat, offensive words do not justify the use of force in self-defense. Consider the following scenario for an example of such a situation. A jealous ex-lover confronts his former girlfriend and shouts, "I'm going to kill you!" He brandishes a knife and steps forward. In this case, the victim would be within her rights to defend herself because a reasonable person would fear physical harm. So if she had pepper spray in her purse, she's justified in using it to fend off her angry ex-lover. Had he approached her and said, "We need to talk," she would not be legally justified in using the pepper spray in self-defense. The use of force in self-defense loses justification once the threat has ended. For example, if an aggressor assaults a victim but then stops doing so and indicates that there is no longer any threat of violence, the threat of danger has ended. Any use of force by the victim against the perpetrator at that point is retaliatory and not self-defense. Consider the following scenario. Two players in a basketball game argue over a foul call until one punches the other in the face. After delivering the punch, the player quits the game and leaves the gym. A few hours later, the two players coincidentally encounter each other in the grocery store. At this point, the original confrontation is over. Absent of a new attack or imminent threat of harm, the punched player would not be legally justified in punching the player who hit him earlier. Under this circumstance, the use of force is retaliatory and not self-defense. Was the fear of harm reasonable? Self-defense is legally justified even if the perceived aggressor did not mean the perceived victim any harm. Let me say it again. Self-defense is legally justified even if the perceived aggressor did not mean the perceived victim any harm. What matters in these situations is whether a reasonable person in the same situation would have perceived an immediate threat of physical harm. Under the legal concept of the reasonable person, legal systems decide whether a person's feelings and experience of imminent danger justify the use of force as a response to a threat. Imagine two strangers walking past each other in a city park. A bee is buzzing around the head of one of the two people. The other person sees this. Being friendly, the other person reaches quickly to try to swat the bee away from the bee's soon-to-be victim. The person with the bee by their head, only seeing a stranger's hand toward their face, might understandably slap the other person's hand away violently. In other circumstances, the slap would amount to a textbook assault. But a court could easily find that the sudden movement of a stranger's hand toward a person's face would cause a reasonable person to conclude that they were in danger of immediate physical harm. This would likely render the use of force a justifiable exercise of the right of self-defense. It would not matter that the perceived attacker meant no harm and was in fact actually trying to help. Imperfect self-defense. Sometimes a person may genuinely fear imminent physical harm that is not objectionably reasonable. If that person uses force to defend themselves from the perceived threat, the legal situation is imperfect self-defense. Imperfect self-defense does not excuse a person from the crime, but can lessen the charges and penalties involved. But not every state recognizes imperfect self-defense as a reason to lessen a sentence. For example, a student is studying at a coffee shop when a classmate arrives and walks toward the student. The classmate balls up his fist in anticipation of a friendly fist bump greeting. The student genuinely fears that their classmate is preparing to punch them, even though this fear is unreasonable. In reaction to this perceived threat, the student flings his coffee, cup at the classmate's face and scrambles away. While the student's claim of self-defense would not excuse any criminal charge for assault, it could reduce the severity of the charges. The student's self-defense claim is imperfect because of the unreasonable nature of how he perceived the threat. Some states also consider instances where the person claiming self-defense provoked the attack as imperfect self-defense. For example, if a person creates a violent conflict, then unintentionally kills the other party while defending themselves, a claim of self-defense might reduce the charges or punishment, but the defense would not excuse the killing entirely. Proportional response. Self-defense law requires the response to match the threat level in question. In other words, a person can only use as much force as required to remove the threat. If the threat involves deadly force, the person defending themselves can use deadly force to counteract the threat. If the threat involves only minor force, and the person claiming self-defense uses force that could cause grievous bodily harm or death, their claim of self-defense will fail. Duty to retreat. The original laws about self-defense required people claiming self-defense first to attempt to avoid violence before using force. This is also known as a duty to retreat. While most states have removed this rule for instance involving non-deadly force, many states still require the person to attempt to escape the situation before applying deadly force. It's important to know the laws of your local jurisdiction to decide whether this duty is required. Stand your ground. In contrast to the duty to retreat, many states have enacted so-called stand your ground laws. These laws remove the duty to retreat and allow for a claim of self-defense even if the person making the claim did nothing to flee from the threat of violence. Today, this is the more common rule when situations involve non-lethal force. But states differ on whether the stand your ground principle applies to lethal force situations. Castle Doctrine. Even in states that require a person to retreat from the threat of imminent harm before defending themselves, a person can often use deadly force against someone who unlawfully enters their home. This rule, also known as the Castle Doctrine, allows people to defend their homes against intruders through the use of deadly force. Additional material on the Castle Doctrine is available with research, but when in doubt, it is always a good idea to consult a local attorney for legal advice on this matter. So here's the deal. In several different exchanges, I was taught by my senior instructor along the way that no matter what happens in my effort to defend myself on any given day or night, it was better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6. Although none of us want court proceedings or the chance of being incarcerated, another final quote for you and your circumstances to consider towards your final perspective on this topic is that self-preservation is the first law of nature. In the final analysis, we should be aware, be smart, and avoid trouble wherever we can, but stay alive. So let's move forward here now and discuss a sample 10 self-defense strategies that everyone should know to survive. The best self-defense strategies and techniques work equally well for men and women. But let's face it, women really need them because they're assaulted more often than men. Statistics indicate that 1 in 3 women will be the victim of some type of violent attack in her lifetime. Women also endure more incidents of verbal and sexual harassment. Although most women's self-defense courses focus on skills for quickly and efficiently destroying an attacker, Self-defense training also should include methods of preventing confrontation from turning physical in the first place. Your very best weapon in the pending self-defense situation is always awareness. Being alert, proactive, and reading your environment, then removing yourself from a dangerous or questionable situation, is high on the list of how to avoid harm when danger is approaching. Evading an attack is superior to blocking one. Here are a number of effective real-life situation-tested self-defense concepts and techniques that anyone can use. If you're an experienced martial artist, the physical techniques may appear familiar or even surprisingly basic, but that's fine. They're intended to be simple because in an assault, you'll experience fear and panic along with a natural adrenaline rush. Despite the superhuman effects adrenaline can produce, we've all heard stories about the grandmother who lifted a car off her trapped grandchild. It doesn't always work in your favor. You may experience tunnel vision, auditory exclusion, and loss of fine motor skills. Consequently, it will be hard to see and hear, and complex martial arts techniques may be impossible to perform. If you stick with proven strategies and simple gross motor movement techniques, such as the 10 described here, your chance of surviving will increase drastically. Number 1. Trust your instincts. Too many women enroll in a self-defense class after they've been assaulted. When they recount the incident, they often say the same thing. I had this bad feeling, but I told myself not to be paranoid. Or, I knew I shouldn't have gone, but I didn't want to hurt his feelings. If something doesn't feel right, it probably isn't safe. That's the bottom line. Many women have been conditioned to ignore the little voice that tells them trouble is coming. Your instinct is the best detector of danger. Always, always, always trust your intuition. Call it woman's intuition, sixth sense, gut instinct, a feeling, whatever. The bottom line is trust it. That feeling is a psychological and physiological response to your environment that has been hardwired into your being over the evolution of our species. Instinct or intuition is an exceptionally sophisticated defense system that picks up on things you are not attuning to on a conscious level. It is below your everyday awareness. And keep eye contact with the threat. See him or her. Make sure you keep your eyes on. The next time you hear that little voice inside, listen to what it's saying. Number 2, practice being target elusive. Don't make yourself an accessible target. The outcome of a battle is often determined before the first grasp or before the first blow is struck. When you have the opportunity to escape from a situation before it turns bad, take it. If an approaching person gives you the creeps, walk to the other side of the street. If an elevator door opens and the guy standing inside makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up, wait for the next elevator. Those actions aren't cowardly. Rather, they're a smart way to eliminate danger. Number 3, present yourself with confidence. Be aware of the message your body sends to those around you. Like animals, human predators target those they consider the weakest or most vulnerable. Attackers search for women who appear frightened, confused, or distracted. They look for women who walk with their head down and their hands stuffed in their pockets, or perhaps one who's overburdened with packages or distracted by children. Remember that attackers do not want to work too hard or get in a fight. They want an easy mark. By walking with confidence and awareness, looking around and keeping your head up and shoulders back, you'll dramatically reduce the likelihood of becoming a target in the first place. keep your head on a swivel. Number 4, set strong verbal boundaries. Good verbal skills are an effective self-defense tool, one you're likely to use more frequently and successfully than other physical technique. When a predator engages you in conversation, he's actually interviewing you to see if you'll make a good victim. An experienced attacker is practiced at using his words. If you stand tall, remain calm, and respond confidently and assertively, you'll probably fail his interview. The power of your voice alone can cause him to seek an easier target. Number 5, maintain a non-confrontational stance. In a self-defense situation, one of your secret weapons is the element of surprise. Most predators feel confident that you won't defend yourself, and you should capitalize on that misconception. If you assume a strong, balanced stance, it immediately tells the attacker that you know how to fight. In response, he'll likely be even more aggressive. Instead, use a confident, relaxed stance in which your hips and shoulders are forward, your arms are bent, and your hands are up and open. This conciliatory posture may mislead the attacker into thinking you're willing to comply. If it becomes necessary for you to strike, he probably won't be prepared for it. Number 6, keep a safe distance. Everyone has a comfort zone or personal space. When an aggressor enters that zone, you're uncomfortable because you know you'd need that space if you had to fight back. The reactionary gap or personal space is the distance you must keep between you and the suspect in order for you to respond to any sudden threat. That distance tends to be 6 to 9 feet if you can see the suspect's hands, and 25 feet if you can't. Think of approximately 1 to 1.5 arm lengths between yourself and the aggressor. The danger zone is anywhere inside the reactionary gap. If he starts closing in, you need to use verbal boundaries like stop or no. If he still doesn't back off, you'll need to get physical. Number 7, use the element of surprise. Most predators assume you cannot defend yourself. Therefore, you should take advantage of the element of surprise. If you're engaged in a conversation, you have the opportunity to use verbal skills and a non-confrontational stance to entice the aggressor into dropping his guard. If you're grabbed from behind, you must respond immediately. In either case, putting up a fight can surprise him and increase your chance of landing the first powerful blow. Number 8, keep your techniques simple. One of the main effects of an adrenaline release is the loss of fine motor skills. That means simple gestures, such as unlacing your fingers or pulling your hands out of your pockets, can become much more challenging, and the odds of your executing a beautiful joint lock or perfect kick rapidly dwindle. No matter which martial art you may have practiced, learn techniques that are basic and stick with them in a self-defense scenario. I recommend the following. Palm heel strike. Hitting with an open hand reduces the chance that you'll injure your hand and enables you to more easily attack from a non-confrontational stance in which you're holding your hands up and open while you set verbal boundaries. Then, if your attacker steps into your comfort zone, bang! They get it right on the bridge of their nose. Eye strike. The eye strike can be used in a standing or prone position. Often, simply driving your fingers toward your assailant's eyes will cause them to recoil. Even if you don't make contact, it creates space to set up a more devastating strike. Knee strike. This technique is recommended over any type of standing kick because it is easy to use and can be delivered while you stay centered and close to the ground, which is crucial when you're adrenalized. A knee to the groin can possibly end a fight immediately. It can be important to step off to an angle, though, because standing directly in front can make you vulnerable. Don't panic if you're knocked down. More often than not, women end up on the ground when they're assaulted. The good news is that most assailants are not skilled ground fighters. They're simply bullies who are used to knocking women down and forcing them to comply. Remember that the palm heel strike and eye strike work well on the ground as well. It's a good idea to have a few kicks that work there as well. But raise your hips when you kick to give more power to the strike. If you are on the ground and your assailant is standing, kicking gives you an advantage because your legs are longer than the assailant's arms. That means they'll have to expose their body to your kick if they want to reach you. Knee strikes also function effectively on the ground. While you struggle with your attacker, especially if he is male, he probably won't protect his groin. Once you see an opening, get close enough to strike upward into his crotch. Number 10, follow through. The fight isn't over until the threat no longer exists, which means your threat is not moving or you have gotten away. Therefore, you must be 100% committed to the battle. If you fight back and then pause, you give the initial advantage you gained from using the element of surprise. Once your opponent knows you will fight to protect yourself, it becomes more difficult for you to prevail. To survive, you must continue your nasty barrage until it's safe to stop striking and escape. Does this podcast episode serve as an expert self-defense training with practical application? No. It does not. But what it does is give you just a simple reminder to stay aware. Watch your surroundings, not with paranoia, but with intent to maintain safety and always make it home to your loved ones. Thank you for joining us again today for another episode of Round 12. May you live as long as you want and never want as long as you live. May the worst days of your future be like the best days of your past, and may you continue to answer life's bell every time. Until we meet again, time!